Today is the 28th of August 2017. I'm interviewing Doug and Sue Potts of Tavlock North. Doug is a retired sign writer, and he's going to tell us something about the life and times of his family. Doug, would you like to...
From the beginning, my grandfather on my father's side came from Hawick in Scotland, arrived in Invercargill, or Gore actually, in Invercargill down there, married my grandmother who came from Scotland, but I don't know what place she came from. He was an undertaker in Invercargill and died at a very young age. Well, there was six kids, and my dad was the oldest at 13, so an indication when he died. And so the boys and grandma went through the Depression in 30, 31, around that era, the Depression, and things were pretty tough. And I can remember asking grandma later, when they migrated up to, and that's another bit of story, though, they migrated up to Hawke's Bay because of the Depression. There was no work down there. My dad was a tradesman, served his time as a bricklayer, and saw that there was more work in the freezing works in Hastings, which was the Whakatū freezing works at the time, and he migrated up here. And I asked Grandma, how did you get on with all those kids in the Depression, which was so tough? And she said, it was the best time of my life. And I said, how could you say that when I hear that it was no food and things were pretty tough for an ordinary family, let alone one with no husband to look after things?
How many children were there?
Six. And she said, they used to come home at night from school, and three of them worked after school. Two of them were tradesmen. Well, one was a butcher and one was a bricklayer, and the others were working after school in places, just doing menial bits and pieces for bobs and food and stuff. And they would come home and sit round the table with a tilly lamp and all play cards. And she said, I used to sit there and chuckle my head off at these kids, all joking and carrying on, and how happy we were. And it was very interesting. So then, as I say, Dad found work in Hastings and came up with the freezing works and was a solo butcher. And I, to this day, don't know how he did it. He didn't like blood and used to come home and mention about it when I was only a little fella. Married my mum. The other side of the family were from Wick. My granddad came over from Wick before the First World War, and those days they must have done a family thing because three of his brothers came with him. So there was four on the boat, came over, and they sort of dispersed. And they went to the wire wrapper because there was farm labouring work there. And he was on the wharf, he was a cooper. Now that's interesting because they make barrels for tallow. And he then came up to Hastings, I don't know what time, but came up to Hastings, met Mum, who went to Munga Territory School.
What was her family name?
Her family name was Lowe, the Lowes. Met my grandmother, to Grandad. She was from Cornwall, and they met before they come over, I think. No, they met here, because they were the Freethies, who were, we're getting them all together now. And Grandma and Grandad had three children, Donald, Winston, and Nolene, which was my mother. And when he came up to Hastings here, he got a job at the freezing works as a cooper and made the barrels for years till he retired. So all that time, at what age, I don't know, 70-something. But in between, come from wire wrapper to here, the war broke out, 1914, was it? And signed up with the Wellington Horse Brigade, I think it was called. Got on the third boat that went to Gallipoli. And it was in Gallipoli, not very long, but enough to see, because they had cleared out. By the time the third boat got there, they'd ordered them back out. And then they went to Flanders and to Brazil. And he finished there, came home and went back to the works, and always used to bike. I can remember him biking all the way out there. Those days there was no cars, well, not many. And he eventually bought a car, and we used to borrow it. And we lived right next door in Evenden Road in Hastings. And it was a long way out those days.
Well, the road was only shingle those days.
Was shingle, and my brother said, "Doug, don't you forget to mention that when they tar sealed the road, we used to play tennis on the road, and one car an hour would go past."
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we were born, and the seven in our family, my mum and dad produced seven of us, Heather the oldest, me, Andy, Colin, Tom, who died about 10 years back, was it?
Yeah, probably.
He had a brain aneurysm, and Alistair, and Susan. And there's 18 years difference between me and the baby, which was Susan, so I used to push her around in the pram. And then, while he was at the works, he thought there's more money in being in business, so he bought a trucking business, and he went along to Bailey Farmers, and they must have saved up enough money for a truck to do just a solo trucking. And he used to, I can remember, I used to help him on the weekends collecting pumpkins. He'd pumpkins on the truck and take them to the railway station. Those days, the trains carted everything, not the trucks. And then another misfortune happened. Outside, the truck caught on fire, and he lost everything. And I don't think he had it insured and lost that. And some families have bad luck, and some have good luck. Things go good. Then a job came up to lease some land at Waimarama, and I was probably seven at the time, six or seven at the time. We went out there to the leased land, and financially it wasn't so good, so my older sister went down to my grandmother in Invercargill and stayed there for 2 years, and the family just all got together and looked after us in that way. And it was lovely out there for a child. I had a lot of fun with the kids, and Dad also had cows, so we had the milk run out there as well. And every morning Dad and I had given a cart and take the milk round in those cans. And it was only a little community those days, so we'd deliver the milk and ladle it out into cans, big can into the whatever reciprocal they had. They'd put pots out and jugs and
all sorts of things.
All sorts of things. The health inspector and have a ball. And then all of a sudden, it wasn't making that much money. Things were getting a bit tough. And Mum was looking after Turi Gillies, who owned the property, and he was a paraplegic, so that was part of the deal. Mum looked after him and Dad leased the farm. But it didn't work out that well, and we came back into town. And Dad went back to the works as a bricklayer then, and a guy called Cyril Cushing was the manager of the works. And that's Selwyn's dad. And Cyril was a lovely guy and said to Dad, "I'm importing a guy from England to build the boilers. And it's a very intricate job, and I'm paying a lot of money for this guy to come out to build the boilers." And Dad said, "Well, I can do that." And he said, "Oh, well, I'm not too sure." He said, "I've got a ticket to build boilers. I got all that down in the car." So Dad got that job, and the other guy was already in transit, so was here about 3 months and had to go back home. And he never did anything else until his retirement. He retired and then worked for Dave Choate for a wee while. He had a little fond thing going with Dave Choate. Dave Choate was a real lovely guy and helped him out just bits and pieces because Dad could do fireplaces. And it was really at a time where Dave only wanted expertise. He didn't want hands-on. He wanted his knowledge. Until Dad died.
What was his first name?
Walter. Walter Caldwell Potts. And Mum always had a crook heart. I came back, went to Mahura School. And then from Mahura, I went on to Hastings Intermediate and then on to Hastings Boys High. Got involved at Hastings Boys High with rugby, of course, like all the boys. And when we left school, I had a friend that was doing boxing, Matty McCullough, that I had grown up with.
Matty McCullough?
Yes.
This is Mike's father?
Yes.
Well, there's young Mike.
Young Mike. And Matty is the fireplace. He's Mike's brother.
That's right. Well, he went to Mahura School with me, and we had a little friendship. And he said, I'm in the boxing gym, Doug, you do quite well, why don't you come along? And I said, well, I'm more interested in my rugby. And he said, you can do the rugby in the day and box at night. We only do the boxing at night. I said, oh, that's okay. So when I left school, I joined the rugby club, which was a different one. It was the Hastings Rugby Club then, sure. But there was too many on the bench, and I was one of them. And so my friend and I, who were both halfbacks, decided we would go to Havelock because they needed players, and that's where it sort of there. Then I got an apprenticeship at Boys High, and as a kid, I always wanted to be a sign writer. It's funny how I'm diversing a little bit. How kids those days tried to map their life out early. Yes. And I was always the arty sort in the family, which came back from the Freethies, I was told, because they were quite arty in Cornwall. And one of them did some art for the Queen or the King. This is only what I was told. And so it must have shone through on me. It never shone through on any of the other kids, although they probably were, but never. And I, as a little kid, my dad used to bring home these guys from the pub. There was 6 o'clock swill those days. Right. And 6 o'clock, the guys have a few beers, but they wanted to finish off. It was a little early before tea. So dad would bring these blokes home from the pub who were mates, and they'd finish a couple of beers, a flagon or whatever at home at the table while mum was cooking. And one was a sign writer, and he worked for Baldwin and Swanwick, the big painter in Hastings. And I had just been passing, well, running past around the table. He said, well, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, I want to do art. That's right. He said, well, you're pretty close to what I'm doing. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, sign writing. I said, sign writing? Well, that sounds interesting. And he went out to the truck and brought me in his brushes. And he put them down on the table, and I looked at them and I thought, that was me. And right from the word of seeing the brushes, it all connected.
Was he Baldwin or Swanwick?
No, he wasn't. He worked for them. I don't know his name. He was an older guy that I don't even know where he came from or where he went. And he was there. They were such a big firm that they'd be painting, and when they did a shop, he would do the sign writing. Yeah. So he was part of the contract. And so I knew then what I wanted to do. So then when I got to high school, I was in class and everybody was going to the freezing works. And I said, no, I want to be a sign writer. But there's bigger money at the freezing works. In those days, some of those boys were earning £30 a week. And it was hard work, manual work, and I didn't really want to do manual work. I wasn't the size for it. But I was determined that's what I was going to do. And Dad said, well, you can do anything you want to. You just have to put your mind to it. And I thought, gee, this is it. So I looked in the phone book and I marked out all the sign writers from Wairoa to Gisborne. In those days, there was one in every town. And I packed up all my artwork in a folder and I hopped on the bus. And first of all, I went to Waipakarau. And there was a guy called Andy Keane there. And he did sign writing as well as funeral directing. Those days, multitasking was pretty well on. He said, there's no job here, but you're quite a talented lad. You'll get a job somewhere. Just keep knocking on doors. And that's what I did. And then I went all the way up to Gisborne. I took the rail car up to Gisborne and went round. There was 3 sign writers firms in Gisborne. And no, none of them had a space. They all had apprentices. Came back and went to Napier, Hastings and Napier. Napier, there was a guy there called Trevor Hayter who had just gone into business in 8 months. He'd been in business 8 months. And he said, you know, in about 6 months' time to a year, I'll be looking for a sign writer. I said, well, could you give me an indication of time? And he said, all right, after Christmas, and I think it was round about June, July, he said, next year, I'll put you on as a sign writer. Now, I didn't know, but those days you had to be in business so many months to prove that you could qualify taking on an apprentice. Sure. And I thought, gee, this is great. I've got a job. All I have to do is wait 8 months. So I went back to school, told the teacher, and he told me I was blowing wind out my nose, and he didn't believe what I was saying. And I said, yeah. He said, no, Doug Potts, you wouldn't get a job if it was the life of you sort of thing. And I said, yeah, I have. I've got this job. So I waited, I got the apprenticeship over there. I used to get in the bus every morning and travel over, and I did the trade, sign writing. When I left, I got £5.03 a week, and out there I had to play board, and of course we laired up in the weekends. We had a little bit of alcohol and clothing. We liked to look smart around town with all my mates. So then I come out of my time, and I'm sitting at, we had a little smoko desk, and Trevor turned around to me and said, well, my 4.5 years were up because I got trade cert. We did exams those days. And because I got trade cert, I got 4.5 years rather than 5. I got 6 months knocked off. And he said, what are you going to do next week? And I said, oh, that'll be interesting because I'll be getting bigger money. I'll be a tradesman. And he turned around and he says, oh, no, no, no. And I said, well, what do you mean by that, Trevor? He said, you finish up next week. And I said, finish up next week? I can't. That's not fair. I'm a tradesman. I thought, he said, well, for your own good, Doug, you finish up next week. I can't teach you any more. And I thought, gee, this is a bit sad. So I went home and I sat on the bed, and Dad came home that night from the works and he said, you've got a face as long as a yard. What's up? And I said, well, Dad, I can't believe it. I've been fired. He said, what are you going to do? I said, well, there's nothing to it. I'll get on the dole, and I've got holiday pay, and I think I'll take 3 or 4 weeks off, and I'll just have a look at myself and see what's going on. And he said, not under this roof, you don't. So you either head for the door or you go and get another job. Those days, and we're talking about the 60s, I think, jobs weren't hard to get, especially if you were a tradesman. So I walked round the corner to Gordon Spurdle, which was Spurdle and Moran later, but it was Spurdle Signs then. Yes. And I said, I'd like a job. I took a bit of artwork round and some of the stuff that I used to do, photos of things that I had done, and he said, oh, what sort of job? I said, sign writing. And I said, I did sign writing and I've served my time. He said, I know who you are. And I said, how do you know? He said, oh, I keep an eye on all the apprentices around this area. And so I said, well, look, have I got a job or not? And he said, yes, you've got a job. You start on
just
Monday.
Just like that.
But everybody knew, so I fitted into it. So then I started with Gordon Spurdle, and I was there, and Jim Moran was there too, and he was an amazing sign writer, Jim Moran. And I was working there for a wee while, and then a friend of mine that went to Mahora School with me called Colin Watty had applied for work in Canada, and I had met him uptown, and I said, how are you, Colin? What are you doing? He said, well, you wouldn't believe this, next week I'm shipping out to Canada. I've got a job in Canada, and that's what I'm doing. He said, come along to my going away party. I said, oh, that's all right. Yeah, where's that? And he said, at the Mayfair Hotel. So I went there. It was packed. And I was quite interested. I said, how did you get this job, Colin? He said, oh, Doug, he said, they're just screaming out for people for labour in Canada. They want to fill it up with immigrants. And being a tradesman, I'm surprised you haven't applied. It's $50 a week. And I added that up, and I thought, gee, that's more than what the New Zealand pound's worth. So I said, well, I'll make inquiries about that. He said, Doug, you don't need to. You just ring them down in Wellington, the High Commissioner of Canada. You'll be in just like that. I thought, well, that's nice. That's good. So I came home and I was all excited about this. And I had friends who came up every year from the South Island. And that's a story how I met my wife. Because Allard Mitchell from Greymouth would come up and stay at his grandmother's place in Nicholson Street, and we were friends too. I collected all these friends, and him and another bloke, Ted Collier from Christchurch, they came up together, said, have you seen the South Island? I said, oh, a long time ago when I was 3 or 4 years old, I went down, my dad took me down on the Wanganella, or the Maori, I think it was,
yes,
one of the boats,
Maori.
Yeah. Down to Littleton, and then we trained all the way down to Gore, where I had an uncle who had a farm, Dad's brother. And so he said, well, you haven't really seen much. You don't leave New Zealand till you've seen the South Island. And I said, oh, okay. Oh, well, I'll do that first. It'll only take me a couple of months. Well, we went down, me and Ted together. Ted worked at Morrison Industries those days. He was a spray painter, painted rally push bikes and Morrison motor mowers. And that was a big factory out towards Flaxmere that did those. Morrison Industries. So we both together, I rode a motorbike, a Velocette 350, all the way down there in August, and he drove a Morris 8 car with all our gear in the back of the car. And it was freezing cold on this big thing, this little guy on this great big, those days the Velocette was a big bike. And I can remember it falling over at Danny Virk on me, and I couldn't pick it up, I was that cold. And he got out of the car to help me get it up on the stand so we could buy a pie to carry on. We got to Littleton, we caught the ferry across, got to Littleton and went into the railway station in Christchurch, which those days was at Waltham. While we're sitting in the station, we said, well, the night's pretty stuffed, we'll go to the pub before 6 o'clock, I think. It's a bit vague anyway, but I remember us asking where the closest pub was, and it was the Waltham Arms. So we went to the Waltham Arms, sitting in the pub, having a drink, and I said, we better sort out somewhere to stay. We had money in our pocket, but we needed somewhere we called it Diggs. And these three girls walked in and sat down and said, do you mind if we have a drink with you guys? Well, we thought all our Christmases come at once, but it wasn't really that way. Anyway, they said, where are you from? We've never seen you blokes. And we said, oh, we're from up north. Where are you staying? We said, oh, we haven't got anywhere to stay. Oh, we've got a house round the corner's got 5 bedrooms. Come round and stay there for a couple of nights till you get sorted out. Oh, that's good. So then I went to the bar, and those days we had big glass jugs at the bar, and I stood at the bar to get another jug each with a smile a mile wide on my face. Got somewhere to stay. And a guy at the bar turned round and leaned over and said, you're not from here, are you? And I said, no. He said, where are you from? I said, oh, well, I'm from Hastings, actually. He said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a sign writer. I've just come down with a mate of mine to see the South Island. He said, a sign writer? I said, yeah. And I'll never forget his name, Pat Stenhouse. And he gave me his card from Sign Displays. He said, you start on Monday, I'm desperate for sign writers. And I said, well, I'll be. You sure about that? He said, yes. He said, so you start on Monday, I can't get them, they're like hen's teeth. So I went back to the table and I said, Ted, you won't believe this, there's something in the air. And he said, what's that? And I said, I got a job. Now all we got to do is find you one, and we're right. He said, well, look, Doug, go back and tell him that he takes you if he takes me. Oh, that's a pretty tall order, I said, but I'll try that. So I went back and I tapped him on the shoulder. I said, Pat, I said, I've got a mate that wants a job as well. What does he do? I said, he's sitting over there. He said, what does he do? I said, he's spray painter. And I told him the story about he paints bikes and motorbikes he did. And he's very good. He said, I need one of them too. You tell him. You bring him on Monday too. And I said, well, you don't really know, you know, how I'm desperate. So he had a big company of 14 sign writers and 3 fitters and about 15 engineers. And he used to do all the petrol stations that were those days Atlantic and Mobil. And those days they used to fit a whole service station, and he had a continuous contract from Invercargill to Christchurch. When I first arrived there, it was amazing because I'd only ever worked in a company of 2 or 3 guys. 14 or 15 sign writers was just amazing, and they were in groups of 3 or 4 in a gang, and they would go out and do jobs, and they'd come in, and all the jobs were on the wall, and they'd have cards they'd take out, and away they'd go. But anyway, I was assigned to this guy, Merv Smith, who was an Australian guy and a classy, clever sign writer. I'd never struck things like this before. But he was an alcoholic. And Merv and I were teamed up and we got on so well. And there was a dry cleaning company in Christchurch called Checkers. And they had 57 vans. And we did one a week. And they were all different coloured squares on this called Checkers. And after about 5 or 6 weeks, 7 weeks, I got a bit sick of doing these vans. Not that I worried, it was all interesting, but I wanted to get my teeth into something else. Pat came to me one day after a couple of months working there, and he said, "Have you seen the South Island, Doug?" And I said, "No, no, but there's a long weekend coming up. We've got a mate in Greymouth, and Ted and I are going to do the rounds. We've bought an old car, an old Hudson Terraplane, and we're going to go and do the rounds a couple of weeks of time." And he said, "Well," he said, "here's your chance. I'm putting you with this gang that are going and fitting all the Atlantic signs, and they have all the instructions. You just do your job, and they will tell you where they're going." And so we set out like a circus wagon, three trucks with all the gear on, and away we went. And I had all my brushes and paint and stuff in the back of one of these trucks, and away we went with all these. The train would drop off all the equipment, the signs that were pre-made to go on the roof, the big polystyrene signs, Mobile or Atlantic, and they were on a frame. So we had engineers and painters and sign writer. I was the only sign writer. And I can remember getting to Dunedin, and one of the guys in the gang was a friend of someone at the university, and we went to a party, and it was amazing, this party. The university students those days were just as silly as they are today. Yeah. There was a human skull with a candle in it on the mantelpiece, and they all went to the toilet in the bath. I can remember that. It was upstairs. Oh. And instead of coming down and going to the toilet, they all went in the bath. And they were just, it was amazing to me. I'd never seen anything like this before. They were, and funny as a fight. Until one guy dived in, they bet him £5 to dive in the bath. So he jumped in the bath, and they threw him out in the morning in the sun under the hydrangeas, and the sun got on him. He was terrible. But we did the signs there, and then we moved on, and I never forget, I was getting a little bored because all I did was the little bits and pieces of the sign writing. And we got to Invercargill, and it was snowing, and I said, "I want to help, because all I'm doing is sitting in the hotel, reading the paper, and I know our meals and everything's all supplied, but I'd like to help, do something." I was an active kid. And they said, "You can't, the union won't let you do anything with the engineers and the painters. You're not in our union, so you're not allowed to touch anything." Strong unions those days. And my job was putting the men's and ladies on the toilets and the hours on the window and the door coming in. That's all I ever did. And the guy that owns it across the doorway, the licensee across the doorway. It would take me probably 3 hours, the whole job, all up. But we were there 3 days. So it was a bit of a boring sort of a, but interesting when I really wanted to help. And I did that for about a year, 2 years. And then my sister was getting married in Hastings and said, "You've got to come back home for my wedding." And I said, "Well, okay." I can't remember what time it was through the year. And I came back up after 3 years in Christchurch. Came up to Hastings, back to Hastings, and met up with my old group, the rugby group and what have you. And they said, "Why do you want to go back there?" And I said, "Well, no reason really. I've got a good job there and everything's good. Oh, I'll stay here. We're having a load of fun here." And at that point, I had met my wife. And so I stayed. I never went back. No, I didn't meet you at that point, did I? While I was up here, I needed another job. That's right. And Spurdles were full. They had enough guys, and I didn't go back. But Peter Pan Ice Cream in Waipakarau needed a travelling sign writer. And so that was my first introduction to contract work. And I was contracted for, I'm trying to think how much it was, but it was exceptional money. It was something like $10 an hour or £10 an hour. Big money. But I had to do contract, which was, you know, you understand that you're not paid by the hour, you're paid by the time.
The quicker you do it, the more money you make.
Yes. Yeah. And so we used to paint and write, or I did, all the Peter Pan shops, which he would go and get. He'd toss out Tip Top and say, take my product. Mm. And I'd paint the whole thing white and the blue and red signs on it, Peter Pan. And that went on for a while. I think I was there a year, and then National Service came up. And that's another interesting part of my life. I got drafted into the Army for the National Service, which I think's 3 months. I'm trying to remember what it
was. It was 3 months.
3 months. Okay, so that's another part of my life that, and I didn't like that at all. That was a bit regimental. And
where were you sent?
I went to Wairu, and from Wairu, I did my basic at Wairu, and then my final at Burnham. I enjoyed Burnham. Oh, yeah, I could tell you stories about that too. And I can remember going on manoeuvres in Burnham with a guy that was from Gore. And I said, what's your name? He said, Tex. We used to team up. They'd put you in a group and you had to do a live off the land, I called it. And they'd drop you off in covered trucks way up in Little Malaya Bush, they called it. And you'd have to have a compass and a ration pack and find your way back in 5 days, 6 days. And he said, stick with me, Doug. We'll be right. And I said, oh, I don't know. I don't know about you. I think these guys over here know what they're doing. He says, I'm telling you, stay with me. And I said, why? He said, I used to work here. I know all this land here. He said, they're all going the wrong way. Forget your compass. Come with me. So we walked over a couple of fences. We must have walked 12K. And he said, over this ridge, we'll be safe. And I said, I think we're going the wrong way. He said, no, we're doing it right. So we come over the ridge and he looked down and here's a building. He says, see that building? That's a pub. I said, how the hell did you know that? He said, I worked all around here. We knocked on the door and it was one of his relations, was an uncle. And we hadn't even touched our ration pack. We'd got in there and he says, come in, boys. Well, we stayed there for 3 days, I think it was, at this pub, by the fire, drinking and eating the best of the food. And this bloke, his uncle it was that owned it, had an old Jag, a Mark V, if I remember right, one with the big boot came up. I hadn't seen any around lately, but an old Mark V. He said, you boys, just tell me when you want to be taken back. And I said, well, we shouldn't go back too early, and we don't want to go back too late. He says, no, it's all right, we'll sort it out. So he timed it where we went back about 7 hours before we were meant to be back. That gave time for the others, quick ones, to be back. And he dropped us off about 5K, 6K from Burnham Camp. And I can remember walking in there and we said, well, we better scrub our boots up a bit and get sorted out here and roll our sleeves up and look like we've been a few days in the bush. And we wandered in there and there was never a question asked. And I always remember that. I never ever knew what happened to Tex. But he could sing and he loved the guitar, old Tex. But there was a few things in the army that were interesting. Yeah, I had some hard times there, trying to think. Oh, there was a time there where we did grenade practice. And I was only a short little fella, and we used to have, one day we had priming grenades, and they were teaching us how to pull the pin and throw the grenade. And we'd seen movies of all this, war movies, and it was nothing like that at all. The grenade, you had to put a timer at the bottom of it, and the pin you couldn't pull out with one finger and your teeth and whatever, like the American Marines did. So we were taught all this, and you did it by numbers. So we all went down to the grenade firing range, and there was a concrete bunker. And one at a time, the sergeant would take you along a ditch, a drain. And you'd look over the drain, you'd stand there, and it was about head height. You'd stand there and see a 44-gallon drum. And he'd say, right, what you've got to do is by the numbers. There's a guy up top in a box on a pedestal. And he will call the numbers out. One, you put the grenade in your hand. Two, you pull the pin. Three, you pull the arm back. Four, you fire it. Throw it. And you get it, if you can, inside the drum, or close to. I thought, oh, gee, this seems all right. Well, I had to stand on my tiptoes to even see the Tom. So I got all panicky, and they do, because they hiss. Grenades don't, they're not quiet and silent. They hiss and a bit of stuff comes out of them. And I panicked. And I pulled my arm back at one, hit the bank behind me, and it fell out of my hand and rolled underneath me, this grenade. And I can remember freezing, and my eyes were like saucers. And the sergeant just grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and says, "Come on, son, I think we better get out of here. Let's go." And he picked me up off the ground, and my feet were still in a crouch position. And he took me back to the bunker, and the boys turned around and said, "What's wrong, Potsy? We didn't hear yours go off." I said, "You will soon." Well, there was bits of shrapnel went everywhere. And I always remember that. It scared the army really, yeah. But there was a lot of guys at that time, the Vietnam War was on. And a lot of the boys wanted to sign up and go there, and they went. One was Rodney Fox from Hastings. I'll never forget Rodney Fox. And that's another story. When he came back on leave, we all went to the hotel. We were all underage, because you could go into the army at 17, go to Vietnam. And he came back and he rounded all his mates up, and he was underage, and the police kicked us all out of the hotel, the Mayfair Hotel. We said, "Look, we're only having a quiet beer with..." We explained it all, but didn't go down with those young policemen. So we all got ordered out of there. That was probably the last of that. Then Allard Mitchell came down from Greymouth every year to his grandmother's, as I said, to Nicholson Street. And we had a real tight friendship going there. There was about five of us at the time. We'd do everything together. We would go those days to what they called the Top Hat Dance Hall on the weekends at Napier. Yes. And he had a little cousin who used to stay there because her parents were both working at Nicholson Street too. And I can remember he borrowed his granddad's car, the brand new V8, because his granddad had cancer and couldn't drive it. And we would go out in this car and come back, and his little cousin would be sitting on the letterbox waiting for the paper from the paper boy. And he turned round to me and he says, "Listen, Doug," he says, "you had a second glance there. She's only 13. He said, "Don't you ever, ever look at my cousin. That's taboo. That's finito, you know, nothing." And I said, "Oh, yeah, no, she's a very attractive little girl." And he turned around, he says, "Well, I'm just telling you, Doug, nothing happens with the cousins." I said, "Right, that's it." Well, 3 years on, and Morrison Industries used to have the balls, and all us rugby players would go to the ball once a year, and they were all held at the Top Hat, and I had no partner to go. And one of the guys said, "Well, you know Allard's cousin, give her a ring. All you want is a partner, because you can't go without a partner." And I, "Oh, okay, I'll give her a ring. I know her to talk to." So that was my wife, Suzette. So I rang her up and I said, "Would you like to come to a ball?" And she said, "No, not really, not with you. I've heard about you." And I thought, well, this is Allard's mate. And I said, "Yeah, that's true. But we, you know, we're talking. Look, purely platonic, Sue. I just need a partner to get in." She said, "Well, that's a fine thing to say." And I said, "Well, that's the way, you know." So anyway, she said, "All right, I'll come with you this once." And I think her friend was going with one of our rugby mates, which was Paul Hermitson, which was our lock. Sue Tyack said to Sue, "I'm going with Paul, so you'll be with me." So that's how we all went there, and that's when I met Sue. In fact, that night, we played Celtic that afternoon and got into a fight down when we're having a meal, and the Celts and the Havelock boys sort of had a rivalry, and it was a real handy fists and all, and the girls weren't impressed at all. And so she said, "Get away from me, I don't want you anywhere near me," because we were sitting, and I asked her for another dance. And then we'd gone home, and I can't remember, it was a while later, I wanted a partner for something else, and I thought she would reject me. But I rang up and she said, I have a ball gown. Was it the same ball?
No, it was a different one, I think.
Different ball. Those days, we all got the balls.
Right. Ball season was
on. Yeah, ball season was on. And they said, why don't you give Sue a ring? I said, oh, I think I've burnt my bridges there. So anyway, I rang up Sue in the finish. I plucked up enough courage and she said, well, I have a ball gown and it'd be a waste to just leave it in the wardrobe. So I said, right, I'll pick you up at 7 o'clock. There'll be a group of us in the car. She said, fine. It must have been 9 o'clock I arrived. 8:30, something like that. It was very late. And her dad came to the door and said, what do you want? I said, I've come to pick up Sue. And he said, I'm sorry, but you're best to get in the car and go. I don't think she's too happy with you. And I said, oh, okay. So I went to go and she poked her head out and says, no, I'll go. And her dad said, no, I don't think you should go. Yeah, I'll go. So that was the beginning of our...
It's been like that ever since.
Yeah, been like that ever since.
Come home.
Yeah, I don't know where we're from here.
Well, Sue's going to tell me about her family, where your family came from and where you grew up and so forth.
Oh, my grandparents. My grandfather was a rabbiter at Wire. And he had 4 daughters, one of them being my mother. On the other side, my Pullen lot came from, they were just in Napier, and then they went to Whakatū because of the freezing works.
Sure.
Was the grandparents at the freezing works. There was 3 boys at the freezing works. So the Pullen family were all in Whakatū. They all lived in Whakatū. And my mother was a nurse. And when Dad went to war, the Second World War, all the Pullen boys went to war. The nurses got to pick a name out of a hat and they wrote and knitted things for soldiers.
Sure.
And baked and sent a parcel over. Well, it so happened that it was my dad that my mum got the name of.
Oh.
And when he came, she was still in the South Island.
Yes.
She was a nurse down in Christchurch.
Wire.
No, she was in Christchurch.
Where's Wire?
Wire's where they had the earthquake recently.
Oh, by Kaikouras.
Yeah,
okay.
In there somewhere. Actually, when I look back through my history, my grandma and grandfather's best friend was Bert Pettigrew, which is the Pettigrew.
Oh,
and I can remember as a little toddler going to Bert Pettigrew's house in Bayview. Mrs. Pettigrew would serve us scones and soup there. Just a little old wooden house they had here.
Yes.
It was interesting. I would have liked to actually spoken to the guy Pettigrew before he died and said that I could remember that. Anyway, when Dad came back from war, he wrote to this nurse that had sent him the parcels and said it would be quite nice to catch up. He would like to meet her. And he was down in Wellington, and I think maybe he was in Christchurch. And he would be there, and could they meet up? And Mum sent her younger sister to check him out. And he Faye went and had a look to see if he was all right. And anyway, they got together, and Mum moved up to Whakatū. And it must have been a terrible shock for my mother, from Christchurch to come up to Whakatū, where it was mainly Maoris,
and
in the South Island,
town.
She'd never seen all that before. They'd lived the good life. My grandparents were one of the first in Waiau to own a car, so the rabbiters must have been well paid.
So what was the family name?
Crampton, and my Crampton grandfather married a Sunkel from Banks Peninsula, which was a French area, and apparently we had a farm there. And yeah, I was born in Whakatū. There was 3 sisters. I was the oldest one. 4 years later, there was Linda. 4 years after that, there was Kay Marie. We all went to Munga Territory School. We did nothing really exciting. I was not very clever at school, or didn't like school. I was going nowhere at school, and told my parents I was going to leave high school. I went to Karamu High School. You had to bike to get to Karamu High School from Whakatū. I wanted to make money. I couldn't see any sense in staying at school. And they said, if you could get a full-time job, you can leave. So I looked in the paper and got a full-time strawberry picking job for Eddie Broderick. 7 days a week strawberry picking for Eddie, and that was my first job.
Sure.
My parents couldn't argue. I had a full-time job.
Yes.
From there, I got an apprenticeship at Villa D's Hairdressing with the Linekers. That was going nowhere. You never got any money hairdressing. I went and worked for David Gore selling shoes. And in the weekends, I was at the motorist orchard at Clive selling apples, polishing all the apples.
Little cherry.
Yeah, little cherry now. But in those days, the tourist buses used to pull and you'd sell cases of apples. And I worked there. And then when I met Doug, I was working at Whakatū store for the Burnstones. Used to pile up all the groceries for Tom and Cyril, serve all the guys their petrol, all the freezing workers, their orange lemonade and their box of match. And then when we got married, I worked full-time for Motorist Orchard at Clive.
Who used to own Motorist Orchard?
Boyd Rains. He then went real estate in Australia. Nice guy, Boyd. And his mum. Can't remember Mrs. Rains' name. She was from Wellington, wasn't she?
She was always just Mrs. Rains.
Mrs. Rains. You never actually expected.
So from there, you went...
We got married. I decided the only way I was ever going to get out of Whakatū was marry the first guy that came along, and it was Doug.
No, that's not true.
So at 17, he proposed to me, and at 18, we got married, much to my parents' horror, because he was still a mate of Allard, and they would have liked me to marry a doctor, a lawyer, or something that wasn't...
Allard. Was Bob. That a nickname?
Was that was real his name. Real name.
He changed his name to Bob when his dad died.
Was he named after the Allard car?
How he got Allard. When you look back through our family history, it's an Irish name.
And it pops up through the...
Crampton history. Well, Allard's dad was Bob Mitchell, who was the communist candidate for Greymouth. So they'd had a rough upbringing because of that.
Now, just one other name that you mentioned, the Freethys. We had a Freethy here who had a milk run in Havelock.
Yes.
Was he a relation of yours?
Yes, he's a relation.
What was his first name?
My mum's first cousin was Wynne Freethy. Gordon.
Because he had a comma truck.
That's right.
Small because community. We all lived here all our life.
But you know, when we were kids, the population of New Zealand was 1 million something. Yes. And now, what's the population now, Frank?
It's nearly five.
Nearly 5 million. So in that little spate of time. Mm. So we were all connected and lived together. That was interesting.
So then you were married.
My parents said we could get married if we owned a house because we were underage. I did threaten to get pregnant, which probably wouldn't have worked, but I was determined I was getting out of there. So we looked all through Hastings for a house that we could afford and saved some money. And Doug's father had Le Bon Hallur as his lawyer. So Le Bon was the 10% king. You could borrow from Le Bon.
I remember.
So we found a little old house in Windsor Avenue and we plucked up courage one day and away we went up top in Russell Street. Le Bon's office was up top there. And up we went to Le Bon Hallur and, you know, biting your nails and asked him for a loan to buy the house. So he drove past it. And come back in a week and I'll sort things out. He drove past and he said, you've got a good location. I've done all the paperwork. Pick the key up next week and you can have the house.
Lovely family.
Yeah. Le Bon came across as a very gruff. When you were in his circle, you were...
He was the only Hallur in their family that had Le Bon. And he put Le Bon in his name.
It was quite a character. So from there we bought this little old house in Windsor Avenue, which Doug flatted in it with a few bods before we got married. And then when we got married, we moved into there. And lo and behold, we found it quite hard at 18. If I didn't get pregnant the next day, it was never going to work, this marriage. So that's because that's all I ever wanted was kids. And so from there, we went to social welfare and put our name down to adopt a child. And we were told... We could have a Maori baby tomorrow. We said we want a little girl, but you had to wait 18 months for a little girl, and they said you could have a little boy in 4 months. So we said, we'll change our mind, we'll have a little boy. And we had to go through real strict protocol to get, they didn't like it that you changed your mind on what sex you wanted. They used to come and inspect your house to make sure you'd make good parents. They'd just come and go through the bedding. They wouldn't let you know when they were coming. They'd just arrive, go through the bedding. Anyway, they rang up one day and said there was a little boy in Waipak we could go and look at. But you don't have to take your first option. Just go and check it out. So we went all the way to Waipak, and here's this little blonde baby, was only a few days old. And they'd put Jensen Violet on his thumb for the quick, as they used to do, and he'd wiped it all across his face. And I said, that poor darling, no one else will want that one, we'll have that one. So a week later we went and picked up our Jeffrey, and 9 months later we had Hamish. So we had two within a year. So that shut me up for a while.
Well, that's interesting because we adopted Melissa, our daughter, from Waipuk Hospital.
Oh, yeah, and that's where the farm people used to go. I don't know how you could turn one down.
So anyway, it all worked out well.
Yeah, Jeffrey's been a brilliant kid, hasn't he? Yeah.
Jeffrey's been
a model. He sailed through life, and everyone used to say, my gosh, he looks like your side of the family.
Well, it's the mannerisms, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So where's Jeffrey now?
He's in Auckland, and he's a physiotherapist. He served his time with me as a signwriter.
Oh, did he really?
He used to work after school with me and in the school holidays, and I'd say, you know, instead of going out with your mates, because those days the kids would race cars and sure. I didn't want him to do that, so I said idle hands.
We better come back then to you were married, and at some stage you left where you were working and started your own business. When did you do that?
I came back from Peter Pan and worked for Gordon Spurdle again. He wanted me back, and at that point we were married, we'd just got married. It was all the years of age, because everything happened so quick when we were young. Today it takes years. And of course, while I was working there, there was an opposition in town called Dennis Clark, who kept saying, come and work for me. And I said, no, I don't like doing that. I owe Gordon my work, because he's given it to me when I wanted it, my job. So then one night he came and said, I'm going to give you an offer you can't refuse, which he did. In those days, money talked. And I said, look, I'll think about it. And it was a Friday night, I'll never forget. And Sue and I were in this little house with two kids. We had a mortgage and we thought, look, you know, for our own benefit, we'll take the big money. And those days it was bigger money. And so I went and worked for Dennis Clark. Dennis Clark was a bit of a playboy, and had a broken marriage and left me in the lurch after a year, I think it was. A bit longer, 18 months, something like that. Years. Oh, was it?
Of working for Dennis, his marriage broke
up. And I decided at that point, I said to Sue, look, we've got nothing to lose. I'm managing Dennis's shop for him anyway. Mm. Everyone knows me. I'll just start up on my own. And if I only get 10% of what I was doing for Dennis, we'll have enough money if we scrimp and save and do things right. So I did, and I started a little shop. It's all pulled down now. Where
Dress for Less
went there, but now
it's the plumber
Ron Bone, Peter Ron Bone.
Plumbing.
Bones. It was a little shop. It's all gone now, but I had a little shop in there, and I rented it for $13 a week.
Opposite New World.
$13 a week I rented that. And I'm sitting there putting the little, I had built the little shelves and painted things and got everything like someone does when they retail. And I put all my little paint up. I bought little tins because I didn't know how much work I was going to get. And in walked, my very first client was Murray Keynes from Curly Top. And Murray Keynes, Murray and Ray, he had a partner. The two of them walked in, and I used to do all Curly Top's work when I was at Dennis's. And they said, you've gone out on your own, Doug. And I said, yes, I have. I've just started yesterday, and I'm just getting things together. He said, well, here's a list of all the jobs. Yeah, Ray Pearson. Here's a list of all the things I want you to do, all the jobs. And I went home to Sue and I said, Sue, if I don't get another job for a month, I've got enough work. That's wonderful. Jeez. And it went from there. And just different people came in and,
Ray Pearson.
Yes,
Ray?
He lives around He's the corner. Retired. He's retired. Lives around the
So you had all this work for a month?
Had all this work for a month, and I felt really content. And it just kept coming, and I kept doing it, and I was working long hours. In fact, I was working so long that Sue would say, why don't you take your bed to work?
You're always there. Sometimes, though, a lot of that was you'd call into the happy tab.
I would talk. I would talk to people. I was a talker. Yeah.
And there was people there that would come in and talk to you even if you weren't working?
Yes. Yeah. And guys like the Jewish guy,
his name? That had the wool business.
Had the wool business.
I know the chap.
And I'll never forget him coming in to the workshop, and he sat down. And I said, can I help you, sir? And he said, no, but I think I can help you.
What was his name?
Oh, gee, I had it on the tip of my tongue too. Lovely bloke. Anyway, I said, well, look, I'm making a cuppa. Do you want one? He said, yeah, I'll have a cuppa. He said, I came in to tell you, Doug Potts, is I know you. And I said, how do you know me? And he said, I've watched you grow up. I've seen you from a paper boy go right through everything to where you are now doing this, and I admire you for that. And I said, oh, is that right? I said, well, you're the wool buyer. And he said, yeah. I said, you're the one they call the Jew. And he said, yeah, that's true, I am. And he said, I'm going to give you a little bit of advice. I'm trying to think of his name.
Did he live in Murdoch Road?
He built the motel. Oh, crikey. Lovely guy. Little guy. And he sat there and he says, I'm going to give you a little bit of advice. Millions and millions of people and not much land. If you've got any money, you think about it.
I think that was just as we were buying that building Terry Coxon sorted out for us.
Yeah, and I said, I know where you're coming from. If I've got any money, I'll put it into property or land. He said, you've got it. They won't make any more land, but they will make more people. And with that, he had a cuppa and he walked away. And I don't think I ever saw him again. And it was interesting because he said that he liked me and he said I would do well. Nice. I did average, but...
Isn't that amazing that he should come in and say those nice things, having watched you grow up?
He did. He said, I watched you grow up as a little boy, kept an eye on me. And maybe I had attributes that he probably hadn't wanted.
Yes.
I don't know, but... Kids those days always did milk runs, paper runs.
And but we should mention that as we got on our feet with our two little boys, we then had a little girl, Amanda.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
We were very lucky after Geoffrey and Hamish to have Amanda. We were really excited because we had our little girl that we always wanted. I always wanted a little girl. And we lived in Windsor Ave and it got a bit small, so we went and bought a house.
It was a cold house.
Yeah, Windsor Ave was.
Very cold.
Oh. So we bought one in Middle Road, next to the store in Middle Road, and put some additions on it, didn't we? Built a pole house at the back.
Well, we got a deaf boy.
Hamish. Hamish got meningitis at 18 months. Went to hospital. We thought we'd lose him, but he lived.
And that was meningitis that caused his deafness.
Mm-hmm. And we had, our doctor was Alistair White, and I took him to Alistair White and I said, he's not very well. And he said, oh, I think he's teething. Here's some medicines to make him right as they used to. And yeah, I think everyone went to Alistair White in his day. Alistair White used to have him wait out down the road.
Weren't that many doctors.
No. Alistair was a good doctor, but he just had too many patients. At any rate, he said, I'm going away for the weekend. Here's a phone number if I'm away to ring. And I think, what was the name of that doctor? Barden. Dr. Barden. Mm. He shot himself not long after that. I think it must have been me using him. Anyway, at Windsor Ave, we didn't have a phone. You had to go to the phone box. The phone box was broken. I can remember one time it had a condom dragged over it. You know, you just didn't have the luxuries of picking up a phone and screaming at you. Your doctor was like your lawyer. You were actually more scared of them than your lawyer, your accountant and your doctor. You're treated like...
You're dressed up to go and see.
Well, what age was Hamish when he got...
18 months old. It just put him right back. And Dr. Barry was the paediatrician. And he's a wonderful old man. Lovely doctor. He said, I don't think you'll have this child in the morning. But if you do, you'll be very lucky. And he'll probably be mental. Definitely blind. But anyway, I heard him scream as they threw the lumbar puncher in his back. And thought, well... be better if he wasn't there in the morning, but that was life. Doug and I went home, we went back up the next day and he said, well, I think he's going to make it. He was in intensive care for 2 weeks. They sent him home, he'd lost all his weight. He was like taking home a limp fish. When he finally sat up, he'd sit in the corner and just scream, you know, and it must have been the vibration he wanted to feel because he had heard and then had gone deaf. And when we went back to the doctor a few weeks later, he said, well, I don't think he's blind. I think you're lucky he's come out with nothing. But this child still used to sit and scream. And when Doug came home from work a couple of times and Doug had shut the door and I'd say, oh, hi, how are you? And Geoffrey had run and Hamish had just sit there. And I said, I think he needs a hearing test.
Well, he would still be playing in the corner and I'd come and I'd go, g'day, mate, how are you? And he wouldn't answer. He wouldn't turn round.
Yeah, there was no reaction.
No reaction. And so I'd just try him out. So I'd put him in here and I'd go over here and I'd go, and he didn't take any notice.
So we went to our doctor and said we thought he might have a hearing problem. Oh, well, you shouldn't have had that, but never mind. They'd sent you to Dr. Lowe, L-O it was, a Chinaman. Yeah. up at the T&G building in Napier. All the specialists up there. And went up there and he made some clicking noises and some banging noises and said, yeah, he's deaf, nothing we can do for that one, take him away. And you were like, holy crap, now what happens? But they were pretty blunt.
Those days.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
And so then they tried to fit him with these great big hearing aids that went in bibs, and the kids used to pull them out in the supermarket and pull them out and wonder if they could hear on them too. And it just went from hell to hell, didn't it?
Yeah.
There's no kindergarten for him, no one would have him. We took him to Havelock Kindergarten, where other mothers would just about run. They would grab, I can remember, I could mention too, Mrs. McCara and Mrs. Hutchinson, who grabbed their children so their children wouldn't catch whatever my horrible child had with his wires hanging off him and his bag of wet pants, because he had no bladder control after being sick. It had to come back. So there was always a plastic bag full of another pair of trousers or something, and they'd dive for another gate so they didn't have to walk past me. It was one day when I got on the whiskey and I rang Doug and I said, I can't face the kindergarten, you'll have to pick him up. I couldn't do it, eh?
Yeah.
So yeah. From there, there is a law where they can start school at 4 and a half. So from there, there was a woman here called Jan Robinson, whose husband was deaf. Owen Snapfinger. And Jan was a sweetheart. She was a real good teacher. And she would drop Anna, her daughter, off. Anna was a little blondie with knotted up hair and unloved looking child. She would drop Anna off with Jeffrey, and I would take those two to kindy and then on to school, whichever it was that they were going to. And she would take Hamish to Onikawa, where they had a kindergarten, and she taught Hamish, and she would take him, and she was brilliant with Hamish.
Yeah. She had patience.
I often wonder what happened to Jan and Jim. Jim, his name, Jim, wasn't it?
Eventually they broke up because
she was with David Bone, wasn't she?
No, with then John Scott.
John Scott.
Oh, that's right.
You know, it's a tragedy sometimes, life, when you see these people.
They lived in a whole different world to what we did. They had money up there and they were skiing, and she was...
And Jim coped very well with his deafness and ran that business.
They owned quite a bit of land up there, because they offered us a section, but we couldn't afford it to build at the time. And from there he went to Onikawa School, which really pushed my other two children to the limit, because I had to get him to school. There was no school bus that went to Onikawa. So at 9 o'clock in the morning, I had to drop one off at kindergarten, one off at school, and take Hamish all the way, drop him off, and then at 2:30, I would have to go back, pick him up from Onikawa. Used to take Amanda out of kindergarten, and there was always, I haven't heard story time yet. I'd have to take her out of kindergarten and go and get Hamish, and then come back. Somebody will have walked Jeffrey home, or Jeffrey's grandma was a nurse at Watties, and she did shift work, so she could often pick up Jeffrey. And that went on for a wee while until it got that hard that you couldn't cope with that, and Hamish wasn't coping. And then they sent him to Van Ash College in Christchurch.
Well, we requested... He was getting... When you go through adolescence, it was very hard for us to teach him all those things of sexually and hygiene, those things. And that school was designed for that, we weren't allowed to go to it, you know, like...
They said the family came first and he must stay
with the family as long as possible.
Which wasn't working. None of us could understand what he was going on about. He couldn't understand what we were going on about. We weren't trained. We were trained to sit on our hand because he had to be in an environment where people spoke. There was no sign language.
Canada was the leader teaching the deaf, and they were saying these kids have got to go out into the world with normal people. So don't try teaching them sign language, because it's only them that can use it. No one else knows about this except the deaf.
And little did we know, and it's only lately that I found this out, that the deaf kids were actually going sign language with no one
looking.
Yeah, and doing their own type of language. When they were at school, they were flat tack doing...
Like monkeys.
Yeah.
And so when we took them down to Christchurch, it was a whole new... door open, and I can remember we stayed on campus. They had a school with Van Ash. It was an amazing place, and I think it was started by the Steiners originally, but the government, I think, the Finnish finance.
Well, it started by the Van Ash family, who came out Are they German Dutch or something? And they came here too with aerial mapping.
That's right.
And that was another brother that was in Christchurch. Yes. The school was fabulous. They had their own kitchen where they would do all the meals. They had their areas where you could sleep and go and stay there on the school and visit your children. Sure. It was great, wasn't it?
And I can remember we were there a day, and that night he came to our room. We hadn't seen him all day. The kids went to their classes and whatever. He came back that night and said, "You go home, I'm staying here. These are my friends." And at that point, we knew that the change was there, the change inside him.
He wanted to be with that lot.
He wanted to be with them. They were his. And the deaf are like another whole different body of people.
Well, none of us, unless we were deaf.
No, wouldn't understand.
They have their own. We were just talking about the other day to one of the advisors. They have their own way of texting. They have their own way of thinking. They have their own. It's really strange to get inside their circle.
Of necessity, they've had to develop communication skills that we would not even
think about.
So how long did he stay?
He was at Van Ash College for probably 5 or 6 years. And then at Van Ash, there was 5 committed suicide within 3 or 4 months. They just couldn't see that they had a big picture to get away. You know, they went through school, and then they were told, right, now you can go into the job force. They weren't trained to get a job. And Hamish came home one holidays and said, "No, I'm not going back. I'm scared. They're all dead. And maybe one day I'll be dead." And so we kept him home. He was old enough then to get a job. Warehouse was just starting. And there was a guy called, what was his first boss at the warehouse? I went to Wins, and there was a guy at Wins that said, "Oh, look, this guy's just wanting trainees for the warehouse. He's just opening the warehouse and we want a whole lot of people to stack shelves." So Hamish's first job was at the warehouse down at Storford Lot, and then it moved halfway, and then it built that new building. And Ian McLean, who's here in Havelock, was his big boss. And it was like a family. There was probably 20 of them, and they knew each one. They were like a big family, weren't they?
They looked after him.
Ian and Ray were wonderful people. They still are wonderful people. And they would have Christmas parties out at Waimarama, because one of them, what was his name, that had the house out at Waimarama? I've forgotten that. Anyway, he used to have family barbecues out there, and they all got on. And Hamish was good there. And then Ian gave up being the manager of Hastings, had shares in the warehouse instead of being the manager.
It got too big for them, and they were ready to.
And the new guy came in and said, "Right, the pricing is now done in Auckland. It's not done in Hastings. So everything will come priced. There really isn't a job for Hamish as he knew it. He can now be the cleaner. You can go out and get the trolleys and you can clean the toilets. You can," and there was the woman's toilets, the dusting. And to Hamish, that was, it's wrong. I'm a shelf stacker, not a cleaner. And he went to the boss and told him, "Cleaning is woman's job, not mine." So at the time, I had a sister that died in Melbourne. And in her will, she'd left me 2 little boys. And so to Hamish, it was like, whoa, more children are coming, I'm off. So he went to Palmerston to live. And he got into quite a bit of trouble in Palmerston, didn't he?
Yeah.
He didn't cope very well.
On his own, he couldn't cope. He wanted to, he's a man.
Without that parental background, he didn't cope. And he got into a bit of marijuana, and he kept jobs. He worked for, there was a big supermarket there, it's not here. It's like Pack and Save in the mall there. He worked there. And then he got a job for Georgie Pye, and he was working for the guy from here that owned Georgie Pye.
Oh, he used to have a fish and chip shop up here in Havelock. What was his name?
Where Pippies are.
That was a fish and chip shop. It wasn't Duncan, it was before Duncan.
He had Georgie Pye in Palmerston. Right. And then it closed.
But he hired Hamish.
He hired Hamish and got to know Hamish, and he was good. Yeah, and Hamish enjoyed that. But then Hamish got into a bit of drugs and a bit of trouble. And we had to bring him back home. He's grown through that now. But so when his day does collapse, he can go along for weeks quite happily, and then his day will collapse. And we have to either go to the police, or we have to sort something out and get him running smooth again. So we need him closer where we can do that. Because to go to Palmy every time something went wrong, it was too hard. So yeah, we bought him a flat through Murray Keynes, and he was lucky enough to get a job. He applied for a job in the paper for an assistant cleaner for Mr. Mackesy, and there he worked until recently. Health and safety has actually killed two jobs. So he's now unemployed, and he'll be lost again for a little while.
Something comes up.
Yeah. Sue's trying to keep him occupied. But he's accepting it slowly, just gradually, without cutting it off straight away.
Now, just one thing you mentioned, there was anti-sign language. Do either of you?
I can do it.
We do the basics.
I can do it enough that it'll save me. But when you get amongst the deaf, if I go to the Napier Deaf Club, and they're all going,
They're too fast for me.
I can work out a few of them. Some of them are easier to talk to than the others, and you might go to one that's easy to talk to, and then you say something, so they'll ask the harder one. Mm. They often have an interpreter there, because now there is funding for interpreters.
Yes.
It's still quite hard to get funding.
You can still communicate through writing.
Oh, easy writing. Basic writing.
Because he's a bit dyslexic too, so everything's back to front.
Together. You can understand that because they haven't had the practice. Yes.
When David Mackesy put him off, he got that company from Grow to come in and explain that you are to be dismissed because of this, this and this. And it was a real big letter with big words that even I struggled with, some of them. And then you take that letter away, that hurt, you know, because he's now got no job. You take that letter away and you're allowed a week to think about it, and then you come back and you're told it all through again. You know, and to me, I said, that's cruel. You're just killing him or stabbing him twice.
Well, they're black and white. Deaf kids are black and white.
You know, he's inside. Okay, I'm out. Why do I have to go back for it again? And we were lucky enough to get an interpreter that came in. But even then, weeks later, because he had a hernia the day after he got dismissed, so he went to hospital and he was told he had to have a month off when he had the hernia done. The month had finished because he was off full time anyway. But after the month, he said, oh, Monday I go back to work. You know, and I had to explain again, no, Monday, your job's finished, Hamish. Remember the lady said it's finished? Oh, you're finished, that's right. So it's taken him a little while to realise.
It's hard to imagine what it would be like.
There's a lot of people out there.
Nobody want me.
And I remember as a kid, when we first had Hamish in Windsor Ave, Murray Keynes came round and said...
No, that was here. That was in Middle Road, because Murray lived down the road from us.
That's right.
Yeah. Murray's little one had biked into the pool.
Mm.
I am a little thankful for what happened. I lost a child too. But mine was like that in the swimming pool, and yours you've got for life. And it was interesting, just the way he said it, saying that my sympathy goes with you. And that's really what happens. And the Rays were the same. They lived next door to us, and they had Glenda, who was IHC, and he used to take her by the hand every day down to the IHC to work and back again. And it had to be that routine, and said, do you realise you two? You've got this child until you go or he goes. It's not going to be an easy road. And really it hasn't. But
oh, God, no. Each year you think it's going to get easier, and you'll go safe for 6 months and think, oh, this is great, this is good.
Yeah.
And then, boom, there's a brick wall comes flying.
Yeah. But, hey.
Now the thing is, we've got to think of what happens when we go. And it's, you know, like the Rays, it was probably easier because they could put her in the IHC. Hamish is not IHC and would be absolutely gutted if you treated him like that. But you can guarantee the minute any of those hanger-oners that think we've gone, they'll be in with Hamish. They'll take every penny he's got and he won't see it coming.
No.
Now, where did you say your grandfather came from in Scotland?
From Hawick. H-A-W-K.
Dougie's lucky he's been back and seen those places.
And my other granddad, Lo, which is Mum's dad, is from Wick, way up north.
Yes.
Wick is down on the borders, yeah.
And then you had another interceptor in your lives in the form of drones and a pipe.
Oh, bagpipes? That all came about. All Mum's side of the family played the pipes or the drums. And at one time, in the City of Hastings Pipe Band, which was called the Caledonians those days, the whole front row, four of them, were all Lowe's. And Eric Lowe is a cousin of mine, which was the son of one of Granddad's brothers, Bill. And Eric was a piper in the band, the last piper, and on Anzac Day, I'm trying to think what year it was, he had a heart attack on parade at Anzac Day, died, playing the pipes. So he was doing what he loved doing. And when my mum died, it was round that time, and I'm trying to think of the date, but I had a few bob left to me from my mother, and I said, I'm going to buy a set of bagpipes and learn the bagpipes. There's no one in my generation going to take up the cudgel. And so I saw an ad in the paper, if you want to learn the bagpipes, come round to this number. And it was Bill Menzies, who was our pipe major. It ended up, he was, yeah, pipe major. And we sat round the table and he asked us all, there was eight of us at that time, round the table, and read this little piece in the paper and asked us all why we wanted to be there, or why we were doing it. And the kids, obviously, because my mum wants me to, my dad and my uncle was a piper and all these sorts of things, and said, why are you, Doug? And I said, oh, because I'm the last in the generation to play. And he said, can you read music? And I said, no, I can't. He said, well, you might as well go away, because you've got to learn to... I said, look, all I want to do is one tune on the bagpipes. It's all I want to do. You show me the holes, I'm a fast learner. I'll blow like hell. And he said, it's not like that, Dave. And once I got involved, it was hard. And 25 years later, and I spent 10 good years in the band doing competitive work, and I used to go over to the Highland Games and compete, and I got better and better. And then we'd do nationals, and I saw our band go from fourth grade to third grade. We're still only in third grade. They'd love to get into second grade, but didn't. And yeah, so I enjoy that. So now I play at funerals and the odd wedding and birthdays and things like that. And I go around the old people's, what do they call those? The retirement villages, every new year, and play to them. Only the ones in Havelock. Yeah, so I enjoy that. Yeah. So that's the bagpipe thing.
And you still have a love for rugby.
Love for rugby. I was club captain. I coached, managed, and was club captain there for 3 years.
You got an award this year.
Oh, yeah, I got an award for...
piping the boys on. And
I go every Saturday, home games only, and pipe the senior team on.
Any other community?
I did JC's. I was in JC's till I got a shot cock, and that was when you got...
Yeah, 40, yeah.
And I enjoyed that. We did a lot of fundraising. The Christmas trees, we...
That was Hastings?
Hastings, JC's.
Yes, I've got boxes of things about the JC's I got from a chap that used to live in Nottingley Road. He moved to Christchurch recently.
And Warren Duff?
Yes, he was supposed to come back to me and talk to me about the JC's, because... all these things mean nothing to us.
We could probably go through, or Terry Coxon or someone like that could go through some of the things, because the coin trails and that, you were there when Warren... Yes.
So there were other things I know on the fringe social clubs you belong to.
The Savoy Club.
Just tell us something about the Savoy Club.
The Savoy Club started, I was involved with the rugby club, and I used to sit at home and watch the rugby on my own, a test. They used to have... the tests. Yes. And Terry Longley would sit at his place about 100 yards away, and I'd go around and I'd say, oh, Terry, I've come round, I'll take a couple of bottles of beer around. And he said, oh, look, Doug, it's not a... you remember the old days we had oranges and saveloy? Yes. And I said, yeah, oranges and saveloy. So he went and cooked up some little Cheerios, that's right, and he brought out a plate of those at half time. And I said, gee, this is like when we were kids. And Terry's a lot older than me, but we hit it off there. And then we started joking and getting a few beers in. And before you knew it, others would say, oh, we'll come and watch the game with you on the TV.
They had to be good saveloy eaters.
Well, yeah, and it grew from there until we got cocky, and we had this thing going about... every week we're going to have different saveloys from a different shop. Then there was people like the Ralphs were getting them from overseas, and
We had blind tastings. Blind tastings where they came from, and we had. I think we actually drank more alcohol than we ate saveloys.
And it got quite notorious. We didn't know at the time, but they. Yeah, everybody's going on about. Oh, this Saveloy Club, and we would do outings then. We'd hire a van and we'd go to Paronga Hell.
We even had Saveloys at Tiawa. We went to Tiawa for a meal, and part of the meal was they brought out a saucepan of Saveloys.
Was it Craggy Range as well?
Yeah. And everywhere we went, someone would ring the chef and say, you realise we're the Saveloy Club, could you have a plate of Saveloys there? So that was the Saveloy.
Yes, and you couldn't get in the Saveloy Club until one of them died.
And also you belonged to another group, a breakfast club.
The breakfast club? There was an opening there and we were taken along, I can't remember.
I think it might have been with Terry, was it?
Terry, and yeah, and we enjoy that. And once a month we all go somewhere. There's quite a group of us.
I will admit, since Terry Coxon's left, the alcohol portion's gone down. We probably
not as loud. But yeah, and that's
Something to look forward to.
Yeah, we look forward to it every month. Yeah.
Now, also, you're great walkers. At times, I wonder whether you've got a car or bike.
We have a son about selling one car.
Yeah, we have a son that's a physiotherapist, and we keep saying, health wise, what should we be doing, Jeffrey? And Jeffrey said, listen, all I can say is you are what you eat, and use it or lose it. And so we're doing that. And so we walk into the village, we try to every day, and it might be in the morning, it might be in the afternoon. Sure. We'll walk in, have a cuppa, talk to as many people as we can.
We like to be with people.
Yeah. And come back again. So that's that, yeah, with the walking. I'm trying to think of all the other things. I had 5 apprentices in my time. I'm quite proud of that.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, over my time of being in business, I've taught 5 guys.
You also dabbled in politics.
Oh, you're right. I don't think we'll mention that.
Was part of your life, and you dabbled in politics, and how
I always got into social credit. And then when Jeremy left social credit because of...
Helped him get to mayor.
We helped him become mayor. We got quite close to Jeremy.
Which was lovely.
And a wonderful guy. Honest as the day was long, and always did what he said he was going to do. And I'll never forget when he got elected mayor. And we were working hard for him. I did all the hoarding signs for him. And he said, you know, Doug, if I get elected, we're going to have fish and chips on the floor of the mayoral chambers. And I said, Jeremy, that's...
It was the mayoral table.
Oh, the mayoral table.
Well, we did.
Oh, that's bringing things down a bit. I said, well, I would like to get into the medicine cabinet and see what's in there so we can have a drink while we're doing it. Well, he did. He became mayor. That election, I think he only stood once, became mayor. He was there for 12 years until...
We did have fish and chips on the mayoral table. We did break into Jim O'Connor's liquor cabinet.
Right. I see Isla Dyer.
Dougie's been asked to pipe at her funeral.
Oh, she was a great lady.
I thought she had been older than 90.
Now, I went overseas with them in 91 to the World Cup. And we always met at different places and had a drink. And she always remembered in her will, she wrote, and the daughter rang me yesterday, said, Mum, here in her notes, has got Doug Potts has got to pipe me out and pipe me at the graveside. And I thought, and so what an honour doing that for Isla.
Now, you have a son in Auckland who's the physio. He's married.
Yes, now he's married with 3 children. And
what are their names?
Ava, Sophia and Grace.
He's got 3 lovely little girls.
And my daughter has 2 called Keris and Fion.
Where do they live?
Just round the corner.
In the village? Oh, okay. Yeah.
And Jeffrey lives in Auckland with his 3.
Amanda married a Welshman, went overseas and did her OE. Came back and didn't enjoy Hawke's Bay when she came back and said, that's it, I have to live somewhere bigger. So she went to Sydney, and in Sydney she was a qualified nanny, so she did some nannying. And then she rang us one day and said, you'll be amazed, Mum and Dad, but I've met this guy, and he had an aura over his head. I think they were both in the pub drunk at the time. And I'm going to marry him next weekend. And we were like, what about an engagement? What about some... No, we're meant for each other, and you'll love him. He's into rugby, and we're just, we click. So they eloped on the beach, and at the time we were having a hassle moving Hamish back here. His parents were from Wales, so they couldn't possibly get to Sydney on time. So they just had their little wedding on the beach. And then later on they came back here and lived on the top of our workshop. And from there they bought a house and then another house and had two little girls, two lovely girls. Right. The girls have grown up and are at high school now. And her marriage broke up. She and Steve just didn't seem to get on. They grew apart. And he's now engaged to another lady in Havelock.
Right.
And Mandy's now remarried to Graham McDonald. McDonald was the civil defence guy. That was his grandfather.
Ali McDonald.
And Graham had already been in the area. I mean, I went to school with the Ridgeway girls, and Graham's mother is a Ridgeway. So we were sort of connected before Mandy reconnected with him and, married him.
Okay, you've been retired now for how long?
Nine years, getting on 10.
And sitting in this lovely cul-de-sac.
Very quiet.
Yeah. And lovely neighbours. I haven't thought of moving. We're not really the moving around type.
Doug and I actually part-reared my sister's children when we got them. So we had Ben and Robert.
Got Robert at 4 and Ben at 7.
They went through a dramatic time in Melbourne where their dad committed suicide. And within 6 weeks of that, their mother died. And in the will, they were left to Doug and I. Which we knew that that was going to happen, but we didn't ever expect it to happen.
And so what age are they?
Ben is now a qualified electrician and works for Rowan Brown Electrical. He's bought a house in Middle Road and he's plodding along happily. And Robert is engaged to a girl in Napier and they have two children and he's a chef. Yeah. So for those children it was really dramatic. And my parents really struggled. They used to have them at the weekends and we would have them during the week. And because Mum lost her daughter, she sort of went through quite a hell of a time.
So she used to live in Middle Road?
They lived in Wakatu, and then they sold up in Wakatu and moved to Middle
Road. How long were they in Middle Road?
They were there before we moved.
Is there anything else?
Mum was the nurse at Watties and did the night shift and did the shift work. When she first went into business, she had a coffee bar, the Embassy Coffee Bar, and she used to get up in the morning, her and Mrs. Schofield, and do all the baking. At any rate, they ran the coffee bar and they'd have morning tea, then they'd do lunch, and then at night it was the Embassy Picture Theatre where we would roll ice creams and sell lollies. Yes. And my mother taught me never to give change. You always gave the children a jet plane or a something with the change. And we used to work there till 9:30, 10 o'clock when Dad would take maybe us kids home earlier, and Mum would stay and clean up, and then next morning they were up again the way they went again. And they had that for quite some time.
Just a couple of things I jotted down. I was a judge in 2003 for the New Zealand Sign Association, which was quite a thing. And I'm a life member of the Hawke's Bay Sign Association.
It must have been quite a change within the industry when you moved from the brush to the computer driven. It must have changed things dramatically.
It really ruined it for the artists.
I was the first in Hastings to have a sign computer. That's interesting. And I can remember I used to get, Sue's got a cousin in America who used to send these magazines to us. And in it were these sign computers. And I said, it'll never happen. Never happen.
Never come here.
But it got so prevalent around the world that I thought, computers are going to be the thing.
Yes.
And I can remember going to the bank manager and saying, Scott Henderson from the National Bank, I would like to buy a computer. I would like to borrow some money and I'm going to get one from America. And the problems were there that the American power source was different to ours. So everything had to be altered inside it and I got put off that. Until America made them for the New Zealand market. And there were two in Auckland, and Christchurch had a couple. And it was the company that made the Exorcist missile, which were Gerber, they were called.
Yes.
And I ordered one. Scott Henderson said, leave it with me, I'll look at it. It's a lot of money. It was $20,000 for the first one, which those days was a lot of money. And in the finish, he said, if you're so confident, Doug, and I said, well, this is This is the future. And so that's where it all started to go from there. But I must say, the fun and the joy went out of sign writing for me. At that point, I was about 50, I think. And the excitement of doing hand work and standing back and looking at it and going, that's all my own, had sort of vanished. Yeah. The art side of it had gone.
Did you have to learn computer?
Yes, I learned it on the trot because it's totally different to, like the symbols and everything was totally different to. And in the finish, I'll have to say that it bored me, one, and B, I wasn't that efficient that I had a staff member that was so good at it that I thought, I'll get the client, he can work the machine. So it went from there.
So Doug would go out and about and get the work and then...
And sell it. I sold it. And I have to say that it worked that way.
And the people you sold to...
Sold the business to. Yes, they've still got it. Nice couple. He worked for me. But I had five apprentices, as I said. But I must say that when I was selling the computer, I would go around and say, we can do it within an hour, whereas it used to take 7 hours, 8 hours
to dry.
And they'd say, how can you do that? And I said, we just peel off, stick on. And I had probably 80% of my clients at that point would never have stick-on letters. And they would say, no, no, someone will take them off, peel them off. No, handwrite it, Doug. And I was the last, I guess, in Hawke's Bay that could do gold leaf, do honours boards. Yeah.
People talk about the sticky. The worst thing in the world was ever getting a crease in one and then trying to get the thing off.
The easier thing was to put a little bit of moisture behind it and slide it on. And
But I know we went through all those teething problems until you figured out, you know, most efficient
way. Because you used to do the fire brigade, the ambulances, the police cars. Doug loved to travel. You never mentioned how you loved to travel. He's been to Hong Kong, he's been around the world. You love travel. He married this boring woman that doesn't really like travel, so he often has to go on his own.
Or take Hamish, or go with a group,
Or find some people that want him.
Okay. Well, this, I think, probably completes the story of your life. So, Doug and Sue, thank you very much for letting us see something about the life and times of your family